UK Wine Show, show number 120, The French View on Global Warming with Bernard Segway. On this week's show, we're talking with Bernard Segway. Bernard is from NERA, the National Institute of Agriculture in France, and we get the French perspective on climate change.
And in the news, Foster's post-loss, Aussie's top NZ exports, and stay-at-home drinkers spend more on wine.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 120 for the 27th of August, 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with Bernard Segway from NERA, the National Institute of Agriculture. We get the French perspective on climate change, and in the spotlight this week, we review Michael Schuster's Essential Wine Tasting book. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Australia's biggest beer and winemaker, Foster's, has posted a loss of $286 million Australian dollars, or £130 million, and written down the value of its wine business by $602 million Australian dollars, or £278 million. It's the company's first loss in 16 years and has led to a review of the wine unit to work out what to do with it. Foster's is the world's second largest winemaker after Constellation Brands, who recently put up three of its 10 Australian wineries for sale after a strategic review and writing down of assets. Foster's brands include Rosemount, Penfolds, Wolf Blass and Lindemans, but lower demand for Australian wine in the US and a decrease in domestic sales of bag-in-box have reduced market shares, with volumes down 5.7% to 38.7 million cases.
The quote I thought that summed this up was by an unnamed analyst at Credit Suisse, who said that the wine unit may be worth about 3.8 billion Australian dollars, or 44% less than the company spent on creating it. The question for me is, why do these businesses have to write down so much value? And fair enough, the loss was in the second half of Foster's financial year, and the year as a whole produced a profit of 111.7 million Australian dollars. So not too bad in the long run, but still a bit of a worry. What's up next, Jane?
Well, the Aussies may be drinking less Foster's, but they are making up for it in other ways, according to annual results released by New Zealand wine growers. In the last year, Australia has become New Zealand's largest export market for wine, with export sales up 37% to a record 247 million New Zealand dollars. That's 133 million pounds. Overall, exports reached 800 million New Zealand dollars for 2008, up 14%, while exports to the United Kingdom grew by 8%. New Zealand wine growers chair Stuart Smith said a focus on quality and a strong unified industry were major factors in the 2008 result.
Yeah, I know, it's not really essential news, but I always like to put the plug in for New Zealand wine. I was in Australia earlier in the year, and they really do like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, and it is a bit cheaper over there than in the UK. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, back home, research by Nielsen shows that UK consumers who are staying at home to drink instead of going out are treating themselves to more expensive wines. The slowing economy and last year's smoking ban in England, together with the poor summer, are all contributing to an increase in wine purchased for consumption at home. Overall, wine sales rose by 5%, with the highest growth in wines over £5 a bottle. Meanwhile, sales of alcohol in pubs and restaurants fell 8% in value in the 12 months to the end of May 2008. And figures for the early summer show 2008 has been an even worse year for pub companies than 2007, when wet weather also discouraged consumers from going out. According to the survey, only 21% of consumers said they will be spending spare income on going out. That's all from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories on our website at 3050.co.uk. Back to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. Staying in and trying better quality wine for a lot cheaper than buying in the restaurants and pubs is a fantastic idea. With margins on wine ranging from twice as much as the high street to an eye-watering five times the high street, you can easily spend the same amount that you would in a restaurant and have a much, much better wine. That said, I was down at the local Prince Albert, a very local pub of mine, which has a lovely garden, if you don't mind the wasps so much. when I noticed that they were selling half bottles of wine. Now, I know last week I poo-pooed half bottles, but it got me thinking. Half bottles are brilliant in a pub or restaurant setting. Imagine the situation. You're out on a date. You want to have a quick glass of wine before going off to a show or meal or whatever. And you don't particularly rate the wines that are sold by the glass. They're normally pretty cheap and high volume and not always that enjoyable. But being frugal and only stopping for a short period of time, you don't want to spend lots of money on a whole bottle of wine. Well, a half bottle of wine of quite decent wine, I think is a great idea. Prince Albert, where I had a beer on Friday, they were selling Pouilly Fousse by the half bottle. So next week, I'm going to actually try it. I'll keep you up to date with that. So I think I need to take it back. Half bottles have a use, and I think they let people try better quality wine, only risking a small investment in the wine, both in price and quantity to be drunk. And also, the pub or restaurant can offer a larger range of wines rather than the bargain house wine by the glass. So you can possibly drink a bit better. Also, since you open the wine fresh for you, you don't have to worry about the wines being opened. And if it's a deep yellow colour, you don't have to worry about whether it's oak, oxidation, or something even worse. Of course, as I said earlier, the best place to drink well is at home or visiting friends, with a nice meal and a nice bottle of wine. But if you're looking to learn why you taste wine, you could get Michael Schuster's book, Essential Wine Tasting. We reviewed the book in this month's Spotlight, which is next. So here we go. Essential Wine Tasting by Michael Schuster. Michael describes this book as a how-to and a why rather than a what type of book. And it certainly is, without doubt, it is the best written book on wine tasting that I've read. It is thorough, covering all the normal topics, but at a level that at least answers some silly questions that I have in the back of my mind. Michael certainly has done a good job of explaining wine and wine tasting. Michael's also got the best layout of a wine reference book that I've seen, and certainly other wine books could learn, allowing both the reader to read the book and to also browse enjoyably. Headings are clear and enticing, and bold sections within the page give subheadings. He uses boxes that give you pages of other relevant topics to encourage active browsing the book, and each major section is color-coded at the top so you know exactly which section of the book you're in. It may sound obvious, but many of the recent reference books that I've been looking at don't have them. Michael has also tried to jazz up the traditional sections by calling them before the bottle, and in the glass. The before the bottle section is a fairly standard, covering the senses and viticulture and vinification. All are done very well and at a good depth as well. If you've got an inquiring mind and you want to know how things work, and also get some exercises to practice on how to test out your palate, Michael covers it. In the bottle section, Michael tackles naming wines, the key white and red grape varieties, as well as fortified and sparkling wines. This is a good general section, giving examples of styles to try and what to expect. It's probably the weakest section of the book, but it's still better than many other books that I've read. In the glass is where Michael's book really separates itself from other wine books. It does this by offering a series of tastings to teach the home taster what to expect. While some of the vintage dates have dated in the last year or two since the book was published, it's easy to look at the published date of the book, which was in 2006, and add a year or two to compensate. The key part is the range of styles and the point of view that Michael's trying to make when comparing these wines. Thankfully, included are a set of maps in this book. While they're not the best maps that I've reviewed, Michael has at least included them. There's nothing worse than trying to check where a region is and have to use another book with the maps in it. And that is about all these maps are good for, but they do that job very well. All in all, I like this book. It fits my type of wine reference book, factual, to the point, but also thought-provoking, and in a more sort of way, that for another book on wine tastings, shouldn't really interest me that much. So, top marks to Michael. I actually rate this book 90 out of 100, which is a pretty good rating, and it is a must for someone who wants a very good book on wine tasting. Now that I've rated a couple of books, I've had a look back and realised I've been a bit harsh on a couple of the odd books. I still think Jamie's Wine Science book is the best book that I've reviewed so far, and I've upgraded it from a 90 to a 95. And Janssen's Robertson and Hugh Johnson's World Atlas, I bumped up to a 90 from an 85. The referencing for this is pretty awful, But the depth of content is superb and the maps are brilliant. So I think a higher ranking was due. I think it was a bit tight. Next up, we're going to be talking with Bernard Segway about climate change from the French perspective. Let's have a listen to what Bernard has to say.
Hi, I'm here with Bernard Segway. You work for the
INRA. And
what exactly does that mean?
Yes, it's the state organization for research in agriculture, forestry, and so on, environment. Research organization, which is gathering about 10,000 people in at the scale of a country. And so I'm dealing with the research, especially on climate change and greenhouse effect. I'm coordinating the research within a lot of laboratories, which contribute by various aspects on this kind of research.
Okay, and it's a French-based organization?
Sure. It's a purely French-based organization. It's the laboratories grouped within this INRA organization.
Yeah. Okay. You've just done a presentation at the Climate Change Conference in Barcelona, where we are now just recording this. Some of the things you talked about, you really set a very good scene for climate change and what's going on. But some of the comments you talked about, for example, global warming being mainly affecting the northern hemisphere, so Europe, Northern America, that sort of thing. Why does it not affect the other regions?
It's not my, I should say, view. It's a global view of many scientists in the world, and especially from the experts of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, researchers in climatology who presently agree with this kind of feature. That's to say, there will be more pronounced warming in the northern hemisphere, basically because of presence of oceans in the southern hemisphere. And so it's the first general difference, maybe 4 degrees in the northern hemisphere compared to 2-3 degrees in the southern hemisphere. And the other features is that in the northern parts, but it has nothing to do up to the present time with wine production. It's the warming, especially concentrated in the polar areas. And here it's because of the when you have ice or glaciers who are shrinking, who are melting, the absorption of solar radiation is increased by a very large factor. So there is an interaction in the northern parts, which is already appearing presently now. It's not only science fiction for the end of the century, but we begin to see this kind of signs.
So the ice caps normally reflect a lot of light?
Exactly, so it's they reflect snow, is ice reflecting 60 to 80% of the solar radiation.
Oh, no.
And when it's melting, water, it's replaced by water, which is absorbing almost all the energy and only 5% of reflection.
Oh,
so
okay.
The level of solar radiation, which is absorbed by the surface, is very increased, is increased in great proportions immediately after melting.
Okay. I was wondering that because initially I thought maybe it was, you talked about a thermal lag with the water, you know, because we all know water takes longer to heat up and cool down because of it's just slower than land.
Sure. And it was foreseen for the future, but it's already visible. That's to say the increase in sea surface temperature, which is effective, is slower and lower than the increase of land, mainly because the inertia of water is very large. And some persons are computing the level of energy which is presently stored in the ocean. It's an immense level of energy. So they think that the present absorption, the present effect of climate change by radiative absorptions of gases is damped at the present time by the inertia of ocean. But
yep.
It's something which has started slowly, but it will stay a very large, a very long time, maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 centuries in the future.
Oh, that long to heat the
water? Yeah. So it's a long term. I should say we are. Everybody is concerned with the warming at the end of a century. Many persons ask the question for which is within 20, 30 years. But we have to think that in any case, even if we restrict our emissions, the effect will stay during about two, three coming centuries. Long term also.
The other thing you mentioned was that water vapor was a huge greenhouse gas, which I'd never really thought about before.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying also that with the increased temperature, you're going to get more respiration or maybe...
Transpiration,
transpiration. So
less, more or less.
So does that mean that you're going to get more water coming off vape grapevines and forests and all that, that'll go into the atmosphere and that'll, it's almost like a, it'll speed up global warming?
It's difficult to say because, sure, in the a warmer world, the water, I should say, appeal from the exerted by the climate will increase. But at the same time, because of CO2 increase, there is some physiological change which leads to more or less the same kind of transpiration. But we can have different views about that, and some, for instance, researchers from England last year have already seen some changes in runoff in the continental balance of water balance from continents, and they were suspecting that already there was a change in evaporation in relation with that. We can discuss that because there are so many. But water vapor is a significant key factor in the future, sure.
All right. One of the things you mentioned was that as the temperature goes up, things like bud break will occur earlier.
Sure.
And something I hadn't really appreciated was, sure enough, bud break will finish. That means the vines will be ripe earlier.
Yeah,
but
sure.
They'll
sure.
also be in a hotter part of the growing season.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to land up with vines that will the total length of the growing cycle be shorter or will it just be moved earlier?
No, it will be shorter, that's to say. Flowering will change, but not too much. And as far as you are entering into the season of the plant, the shortening of phases will increase, will accumulate. And for instance, from the recent observation, it has been observed a shifting for an advance of bud flowering by 1 week and an advance in harvest dates by 1 month, at least in France, but I think it's the same thing in the other region. So it's a shortening in general, and so a shortening and something which maybe will compensate the increase of photosynthesis due to the higher CO2. The vine plant will have an increase of photosynthetic production, but as it will be on a shorter period, on the final, maybe the production is of biomass is will be not too much increase because of shortening.
Sure. Does what will happen to the grapes themselves?
Yeah, but the grapes will be exposed to warmer temperature, hotter temperature, not only because of climate change, but also because they will ripe in, say, July instead of August. Mm-hmm. So it will, it's a retroaction feedback, which is positive. That's to say they will experience by far warmer temperatures. For 1 degree of warming, the warming in summer will be 2 or 3 degrees. And because of this advance, they will feel as if they have felt 5 degrees of increase for 1 degree of global warming. So it's the explanation for a very large sensitivity of wine to warming.
So the grapes are going to be harvested in quite a lot warmer time of the year. But
yep.
what sort of... does that mean things like phenolic ripeness will change versus sugar ripeness,
sure.
acidities? What's going to happen inside the grape?
Many things will change, and up to now it has been observed already a change with increase of sugar, so on alcohol, a diminishing of acidity, which is not surprising. That's to say, it's well known that in a warmer climate you have more sugar and so on. So at least in France, but also in California, Australia, it has been observed the tendency towards more sugar, less acidity, and so on. And the question is, in the future, with higher warming, which will be the output of this kind of evolution? There will be changes in the not only in the time of harvest, the condition of harvest, the condition of maturing, and so on. But we can think that maybe the output will be not so significant, because finally, in the past, all the evolution, technical evolution, was towards more alcohol and so on. And maybe we can think that the adaptation here will be less alcohol, more acidity, and so on, to compensate the very important effect of warming, which could be positive.
No, I didn't quite follow that. So
You see, we have seen, for instance, in France, but everywhere, a very large increase of sugar, for instance,
yep.
Less acidity.
Yep.
And it was more or less which was the aim of the producers, to give more alcohol in the northern areas, for instance, and because a bad year was low alcohol, more acidity, and so on. So everything was done in the technical evolution to take advantage of a climate to have maximum sugar and so on. And it's difficult to know in the recent evolution which was the part of climate and of technical evolution. Maybe a climate was responsible for 90%, I think. And as far as now, in some conditions, this change, which was rather positive, you know, in the past, producers were led to put sugar, and it was more or less forbidden and so on. Now it's not too much the necessity, and it begins to be a necessity maybe to put more acidity now. For instance, in the wines of Alsace, it's good years, warm years now, and in the past it was 1 year over two and so on. Yeah. But at the same time, too much sugar, not enough acidity for the true experts of Alsace. Consumers were researching something special. They don't find not too much now with the evolution. So it's necessary to come back and maybe to use techniques not for going to higher alcohol, but for damping this effect, maybe coming back less alcohol, more acidity.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you're going to change the way you grow the grapes to minimize the alcohol fresh. What sort of techniques would they be?
But you can first start from the choice of varieties, but varieties. For instance, we are starting in Alsace, for instance, a selection of clones with higher acidity. So it's first part in the genetics, and as Richard Smart said, there is no necessity to go to genomics or these things. There are enough possibilities in the classics genetic, and it's starting. After that, you can manipulate the microclimate, that's a density of plantation, height of plantation, the pruning, and all these effects. In the past, they were used to give maximum light, maximum heat to the grapes. Now you can try to manipulate in the inverse sense. Yep. You can also go to, for the future, to higher elevations and so on. Not research the warmest situation, but maybe the coldest situation, you know, all these things. And at the end, there is all the enology. And for instance, in Atinra, there was a group which started a few years ago studies about less alcohol, not because of climate change, because of the consumers. Evolution, consumer taste evolution, less alcohol, and so on. So you can think to all the technology processes and so on to give less alcohol in the transformation.
Okay.
Or you can put water, but it's out.
You can't put water in. No, that's naughty. And I suppose if you did that you could drop the alcohol levels, and
you will drop the alcohol, but also many other compounds. So it's Well, it's a wide field of research now.
Yeah, sure. What about a lot of people? A lot of people I've spoken to have said that one of the big drivers for terroir is climate. Mm-hmm. And with a change in climate, obviously the terroir is going to change. As a Frenchman, that must shake you to your bones.
Sure. Yeah, you know, exactly. Yeah. You know, we can discuss about the respective weights of varieties of soil, of climates, and all that in the tradition and so on. But if climate is changing, it's true that one of the main consequences will be on terroir. And for instance, in Burgundy, we have seen one producer. He was cultivating 20 years ago, 30 years ago, old wine fields which were left by monks in the Middle Age because of the passage to colder conditions. Mm-hmm. And he was looking at the maps and so on. He was thinking about climate warming. And so he has bought these old fields, which were not considered as good condition in Burgundy. But now they are in very good condition from 10 years.
Who was that?
Oh, the name, I don't remember. The name is Adelin, something like that. On the bottles, there are announcements about the reference to warming, and he is trying to explain the image. It's true that he is now in the same climatic conditions as 20 years ago, 30 years ago, in the best parts of Burgundy productions and so on. So maybe about terroir, the point will be that if the warming is limited to 2-3 degrees, more or less we will be able to keep the terroir with some adjustment and so on. If more, but there will be many other consequences than that, we 5 degrees, for instance, we can think that terroir will be in real danger at the end of a century, and so there will be a big change. If 2 degrees, 3 degrees, significant changes, but not destruction of terroir.
There was talk about trying to limit global warming to a couple of degrees. So mm-hmm. That in that case, terroir probably be safe. But if some of the more likely cases or the worst case scenarios come through,
yeah,
then
there will be in danger. It's as far as it's similar to the zones which will be invaded by sea or the sea level rise and so on, maybe with more consequences for the life of many persons. But terroir also will be in danger.
You mentioned also some examples, for example, where things are being picked a lot earlier. You gave an example of Châteauneuf-du-Pape where they're picking a month earlier.
Yeah.
What other regions in Europe do you think will be the most affected? Is it going to be more the continental areas, or is it going to be more the Mediterranean, or maybe the more coastal areas?
In terms of temperature effect and all this evolution, more or less it will be the same in Germany, in the north of France, south of France, and so on. After, the point is that in the southern regions, the possibility of having too warm temperatures, too excessive temperatures, and the question about water, water availability, with all that, you can't have different idea between the north and the south. And north, you have a possibility of extending to England, Denmark, and so on. You have possibility to have to change of variety and so on. In the south, it will be very difficult to limit the problems and too much alcohol, too much sugar and so on. And limit between north and south is about the middle of France, from which we can think from the scenarios. But yeah, in the southern hemisphere, it's more or less the same thing. Australia is in danger, but yep, to say, because of warming and more. But They are thinking to move one part to Tasmania and so on. And the same thing in South Africa. Maybe less in Chile, we don't know, but or Argentina, because it's possible to play with altitude more. And
okay, I think we'll wrap it up there, Bernard. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you to you.
Hope you enjoyed that interview. That was our last interview on climate change. I recorded it at the conference I went to early in the year, and I wanted to hold it back for a while, as I think we needed a break from climate change as a topic. Next week, we're going to start looking at Germany. I went to Germany earlier in the year for the annual VDP tasting and spent a bit of time in the Mosel tasting some fantastic wines. We're going to start by talking with Michael Adermann, the Vice President of the Vindeburg Deutsche Prädikats, or VDP Association. It has 200 members, which represent some of the top producers. If what, a bit exclusive, and that only covers about 3% of the area under vine. The emphasis is on quality, so we start our journey into German wines at the very top. But before we finish up, let's have our quote. And this week's quote, I like. Again, it's from an anonymous person, so I'm not sure who wrote it, but it's this. If a life of wine, woman, and song become too much, give up the singing. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.